If you're curious to engage with a lot of the topics we explore on the podcast in more creative and embodied ways, we welcome you to join us in Alchemize, our 10-week audio-based program of daily imagination practices intended to disrupt status quo ways of thinking, sensing, relating, and being. To be honest, without any grant support for our show right now, and we did just get turned down by several mainstream environmentalism philanthropies, this program and our Patreon are our primary means of supporting our labor for these free podcasts right now. We really want to remain untethered to corporate interests, and every small contribution to our Patreon or enrollment in our program Alchemize helps to ensure that we can continue producing these vital conversations that feature voices and perspectives often sidelined from mainstream media. So if you value our work and want to dive deeper with us, join us in Alchemize today at greendreamer.com/alchemize and join our Patreon starting at just $3 at patreon.com/greendreamer. Thank you so, so much for however you are able to support our work during these critical times. We are so deeply grateful.
There are all these different kinds of silences that we experience and that we move with. But for some reason, particularly in Western philosophy, silence is kind of diminished to this idea of lack or loss or emptiness, when really silence tells us so many different things. That's not just about the omission of something.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, and I'm your host, Kamea Shane. Today, we welcome Amer Kangiesser, an award-winning geographer and sound artist working through listening and attunement to approach the relations between people, place, and ecologies. Since 2015, Amer has been collaborating with Pacific women, queer and transgender artists, organizers, and scholars through Climates of Listening, which is an ongoing project that amplifies movements for self-determination in relation to continuing colonization through resource extraction, environmental racism, and ecological disaster.
It's a really interesting tension, this with listening, because I have certainly observed over the past couple of years this really strong desire, I would say particularly amongst white people, to embrace this idea of listening and learning. You know, this idea that, oh, we just need to listen. And there's this image that I always kind of get in my mind of this very concerned kind of white lady with hands clasped together of, you know, oh, I'm just going to listen. I think that listening is a very contentious thing. You know, I think that there's this kind of idea that listening has got to do with care and with kindness and generosity and connection. But oftentimes, like, I'm not saying that listening doesn't have to do with those things, but I think oftentimes the way that listening is leveraged, particularly amongst white activist communities and advocacy communities and organizations, is as a tool of control. So there is this element of listening as surveillance, listening as what scholar Aileen Morton Robinson calls like the white possessive. Stolo philosopher Dylan Robinson also talks about it as well. You know, in Hungry Listening, this idea of the white listener as possessing or having knowledge of or owning, I think Robinson talks about it as square pegs in square holes, this idea that if you listen, you create the knowledge of something that you then have some kind of ownership or possession or, you know, knowledge over this thing in some particular kind of way. And that's that really sticky side of listening as a kind of grasping and taking and controlling. And I think that element of listening doesn't really get incorporated much into the liberal ideas of listening as part of a democratic and inclusive process. So that's really where my interest in listening kind of comes into it. And, you know, there have been a number of scholars, including Robinson, but also Jennifer Stoever and other scholars writing about race and listening that really identify the ways that how we listen is not this universal kind of benign action that everybody listens the same, because that's patently untrue. You know, I mean, I find communicational disruptions and glitches and conflicts really, really interesting precisely for this fact, is that, you know, it's so easy to see how we don't all hear and interpret the same thing. And there's a slipperiness as well in a lot of these kind of liberal discourses around listening that conflate listening with interpretation and listening with understanding, right? So the lack of attention to the fact that how we listen physiologically, because listening is also not just done with the ears, it's a whole body sensorial experience, but that how we listen is the same and how we hear is the same, this assumption, and that what we're going to derive from what we hear is going to be the same, it's a complete fallacy. The way that we listen and the way that we interpret the things that we hear is completely shaped by our social, cultural, economic, racial, ethnicity, our sexuality and gender, by all of the experiences and belongings that we have in life, completely shapes and changes how we listen to certain things, and then also how we define those things. You know, it really is an experience that is in no way universal and in no way benign. Listening is always going to be coded by who you are and your position in the world.
I definitely have sensed that over the past years, especially with the rise of different social movements, like, yeah, like you said, like people are like, just listen, just step back and listen. Like that has not really been interrogated. So I think this conversation is just really important to be had. And I had the honor of interviewing your collaborator, Dr. Zoe Todd, not too long ago. And that conversation taught us a lot about how freshwater fish listen with their whole bodies. And like you just said, you've also talked about how listening is more than about listening for words that are spoken, and also perhaps more than about the auditory experience. So I would appreciate it if you can share a bit more about this sort of more expansive and rooted way of situating the act of listening and how this might influence the ways that people relate to each other and our more than human worlds.
Yeah, so in my work, I talk about listening as a practice of sensing, attuning, and noticing. And I think it's very easy to understand how listening is more than just with the ears, right? I often use the example of, you know, if there is a car idling or a truck idling outside of your front window, you can feel it in your body. You feel the resonance in your gut. There are oftentimes vibrations of sound that we can feel that we don't necessarily hear. They might be out of the range of audibility, either high frequency or very, very low frequencies. But it's certainly something that we can feel regardless, you know. And there's a very famous musician, Evelyn Glennie, who talks about this in terms of her own musical practice, you know, feeling the resonance of instruments in her body. And I think that this is something that we need to be a bit more attentive to when we're thinking about listening, because, you know, oftentimes something will happen in an environment and your body will sense it before you have even registered it on a conscious level and made a story out of it. And so this, for me, is a very, very useful way of thinking about listening, because it really puts, I suppose, an emphasis on the need to be very present and very tuned in to what is happening around us. You know, and I think, again, like before, where I was talking about the slippages and conflicts in communication as being a really beautiful illustration of where we would probably all swear up and down that we are brilliant listeners, but there are always going to be idiosyncrasies there. And I think a part of that is because it's very easy to take for granted, oh, I'm listening, I'm paying attention, but not actually really paying attention on multiple registers with which your body might be actually experiencing sound. And one of the things that I've spoken about with regard to my practice is how this also relates to, you know, non-human communication, listening to environments. And I've had many instances in the work that I've done where I will enter a particular kind of habitat or space. So say, for instance, a forest or bushland or something like that. And we'll notice immediately that the birdsong and the wildlife will fall silent. And that, for me, is an indication that I'm communicating threat to that particular kind of environment. I mean, you can hear this with insects as well. And I wrote a whole piece called Listening is Taking Leave, precisely about that registering the environment kind of not wanting you to be there, or you being perceived as a threat within an environment. And paying attention to how over time the environment might respond to you. So the insects might start making sounds again, or the birds might start making sounds again. And constantly being attuned to that, I think, is a very different register of attunement and paying attention, I think, is often talked about in terms of listening in a political sense.
Hmm. And to go deeper into the idea of listening not being universal, I'm curious if you think the dominant culture sort of privileges and teaches certain modes of listening over others. I'm guessing the answer is yes, but I'm curious what you have to say on this.
The kind of idea that we have around listening is tied to this sort of moral or virtuous position, right? I'm a good listener becomes equated to I'm a good person, or I am in good relation in some kind of way. I think that idea really does a disservice to how hard it is to listen, because realistically, listening is extraordinarily hard. Being attentive and being present takes a lot of energy, and it really requires a lot of practice. I've started to practice saying to people, hey, I don't want to listen right now, or I'm not able to listen right now, rather than to kind of like wear this cloak of, yes, I'm listening, when I really don't want to or I'm not capable of it, to kind of disrupt a little bit this very dominant idea of listening as tied together with goodness, as tied together with like something that you should always kind of be available for, or this expectation of virtue around it. What really needs to be talked about more are the different ways that people listen and what that means for them, but then also the different ways that, depending on whatever state we're in at the time, you know, that we draw stories and narratives and interpretations out of what we hear, because those things change a lot depending on the context we're in, how we're feeling that day, the mood we're in, you know, how hungry we are. All of these different things really do affect how we listen and then what we make of it.
Yeah, certainly. And on top of it being important to interrogate how we listen, it's also important, as you've shared, to interrogate the technologies surrounding recordings. So you've also talked about the challenges you've had with doing field recordings. And I believe you had used the word deadening when you talked about this. And that reminded me of Dr. Sophie Chow's collaboration with the Marind people and how they see Western map making to translate these dynamic living landscapes into flattened and linear representations as sort of deadening the place. And it also reminded me of Dr. Enrique Salmon talking about Hopi elders who refused to have their knowledge recorded because they said that would kill it and that it needed to be alive when it's spoken and when it's heard. So I'm curious to hear you dive deeper into the nuance of this medium of field recordings and recordings in general, perhaps, and what other difficult questions you've had to sit with as you engaged in them for your research.
Recording is a really difficult and troubling practice, you know, and I sit with that all the time. It's oftentimes more and more I find myself not recording anything anymore. I haven't recorded actually in a long time. I think one of the key aspects for me is always thinking about where do these technologies come from and what was their original purpose. And I think particularly if you look through disciplines of anthropology, ethnography, ethnomusicology, the ways particularly that Indigenous people were recorded by Anglo-European people for capture, to this idea of taking a recording of, you know, Indigenous culture and keeping it in some way as a defining characteristic or feature, but also the recording of Indigenous peoples as a marker of their impending extinction. You know, the ways that recordings of Indigenous peoples and landscapes have been leveraged towards colonialism and white supremacy is very notable. And that is something that doesn't get that much discussed in field recording practices, which is precisely why I wrote the Sonic Colonialities paper, because there is a really strong tendency, particularly when people start working with interdisciplinarity, to remove the technology and to remove the method from its historical purposing and to kind of say, well, we're not really connected to that anymore. But I think there is a real danger in that. I think we always need to look at why were these technologies created? You know, what purposes do they serve, particularly around surveillance and eavesdropping and the military deployment? Because a lot of these microphones and things come out of military research and development. Where do these things come from? What was their purpose and usefulness? And how do I then interrupt or in some way intervene or grapple with that history and those purposings of the technologies that I'm using? I mean, I think recordings, you know, it can't really capture all that much. Recordings are a very portrayal of a particular situation or a particular event or encounter. For me, there's no delusion that it's like a representation, like an exact replica or representation of what something is. You know, recordings can only do so much. You're always limited by the technologies that you're using in that sense. But one of the big questions for me was always around permission and consent. And that is something that I've worked on for a very long time now. I started with the questions around permission and consent with recording people that I was collaborating with and interviewing in the framework of projects that I was doing around listening and ecocide in the Pacific. And, you know, there's one set of processes for recording and interviewing people, which are complex and problematic and troubling in themselves. But there's no real instruction for how to seek permission and consent from places, particularly not in Anglo-European cultures or ideas around documentation and recording. You know, this is something that I found nothing about in terms of Western philosophy or geographical methods or anything like that. And I was very, very lucky and very privileged to be able to sit for a long time with people in Kiribati and in Fiji who talked me through, you know, what are you doing? How do you actually ask permission of a place? How do you seek permission to press that button to record? And with them, I kind of developed over a very long amount of time some tactics, I suppose, or some, I wouldn't call it a method, but some indicators where I could understand, okay, maybe it's okay for me to record this, or this is not okay for me to record. And in all of my work, I always erred on the side of no. That was always my kind of base, was that I will assume that it's probably not okay. If I receive a sign that it is okay, definitely, then I will kind of go for it. But 80%, 90% of the time, I would leave something, because I also learned very quickly that when I didn't leave things, things would go wrong with my technology. Like I had one instance where I was swamped by a freak wave that completely destroyed my recording device. And then I decided that I was going to notate what I was hearing and my pen snapped, you know, and I was like, that's fine. This is not for me to record. There are too many signs already now. So that was always the kind of process, and is continually the process for me, is erring on the side of no, because the times that I have recorded where I have received a very strong sense of a yes have been some of the most incredible moments for me, but they are very rare and few and far between.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, an alternative podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our community-powered show and listen to our disruption-free, extended, and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. And I imagine it might be difficult to even develop a sort of universalized approach to seeking permission through research institutions, because maybe the act of seeking permission looks different everywhere as well. So just like how there's no universal way of listening, there might also be very diverse ways of seeking and understanding what permission and consent looks like. So yeah, maybe that's just something else that cannot be universalized like a lot of other things.
Absolutely. And one of the difficulties in even discussing this with people is that you're discussing on a level of energy and spirit and a feeling, you know, and this is something that people often ask me is, what does yes feel like? And it's so hard to explain to someone a feeling in your body, particularly when talking to people who might not be so connected to sensations in that kind of way, for a number of reasons that people might not be connected to their body in that way. But it definitely is not an easy thing for me. You know, it's definitely something that's come from decades of practicing and working on it and trying to figure it out, because it's something that's very important to the work that I do as well. But there are so many things that get lost in translation, or that aren't able to be translated, or that maybe, you know, also should not be translated, which is something that I'm always very mindful of. That, yes, that kind of search for some kind of method, I think, is a misplaced one.
Across the board, your work, like I mentioned earlier, just raises a lot of questions that I think a lot of us have never really thought about before. Like, do we even have the right to record the soundscapes around us? Does, as you ask, the waterfall want to be known by way of a recording? And there is also more technical inquiries, like how recording devices pick up on different and limiting frequencies compared to our diverse living and multisensory experiences of listening. So listening to recordings just cannot actually fully reflect one's experience from that situated moment. And so, yeah, there are also questions of what gets left out. And as I go down these rabbit holes of intellectualizing these things, I also wonder to myself, like, what if sometimes becoming more attuned to the world isn't about sense making or trying to emplace meaning on certain things that we open ourselves to sensing? And what if I'm being invited to just witness and experience and become porously present to the world without judgment or impositions of any of my subjective experiences? And with that, how do I then balance or embrace the both and of listening to just be and absorb, or listening for signs to process or use to influence or guide my presence or relationships in some sort of way? A long ramble, but what do these trains of thoughts bring up for you? And what do you mean when you talk about listening not as turning away, but as sort of turning to?
Yeah, for me, listening is really about responsiveness, which is very hard, right? I feel like so much of my life, at least, is this kind of sense of urgency or rush, or you always kind of need to be on it. But with sound, I always feel like I'm behind the sound in a weird way, right? Like the sound is happening and I'm just kind of following where it's going. I don't know where it's going to go. I don't actually know what's going to happen next. I literally have no idea, you know? And so in just being responsive and being a little bit behind and just following the way that sound goes, I really find that such an incredible way. Difficult. I'm not saying it's easy. It's very, very difficult, because it requires you to always kind of step back. Listening in that kind of way means that you can't anticipate what's going to come. It's really like I'm running ahead of myself again, or I'm running ahead of this now, or I want this thing to happen, or I want that sound to come up now. It's always being a bit behind. And I think for me, that's a really useful practice in general, to kind of always to just let that gap between what I'm hearing and following it kind of be there, if that makes sense. It's like inhabiting uncertainty at all times while you're listening, without any expectation, without anticipation of what might come, but just observational uncertainty and an embrace of that gap, of that not knowing. And I think that's, for me, like, why talking about it as turning toward, turning it into, rather than away from, is turning into that uncertainty, turning into the not knowing, and it being okay to not know, it being okay to maybe never know. It's not about always knowing and grasping and holding and explaining and translating and understanding. Sometimes it's just about following what's going and not knowing.
And speaking of the gap in between, I'm aware that silence has also played an important role in your work as a sound artist and in your curiosities related to acoustic ecology, specifically on the soundscapes of Ecocide. And here I think about how when we look at something visually and then they disappear, it might lead us to see some sort of after image, or after having a snack, we might have a lingering aftertaste in our mouths because of the absence of what came before. So it makes that more powerful. And I know it can be challenging to articulate around silence, but I wonder about the after effects of silence as well, like what might arise when we become more attuned to that space in between, or what is missing, or what is left unsaid. What would you like to weave into these curiosities here?
Yeah, silence is a deep preoccupation of mine because there are so many interpretations and understandings and meanings of silence. Silence is a extraordinarily overflowing and excessive thing, I find. And there's actually someone whose work has been very instrumental and important for me, a Professor Unaisi Nabombo-Baba, who is a Fijian scholar, who wrote a brilliant book called Knowing and Learning, an Indigenous Fijian Approach. And she actually does a very rigorous taxonomy of Indigenous Fijian or Italke forms of silence. And there are like numerous forms of silence that she details, you know. And I just found it so incredible how she brought silence. You know, obviously it's looking at cultural kinds of silences, like there's silence around harvest time and, you know, silence within the village and silence within particular relationships to do with taboo and relational kinships and things like that. But even just expanding the conceptualization of silence from the dichotomy of silence or being silenced, which often are kind of presented as oppositional things, really to kind of expand and say, no, there are all of these meanings and variations of silence in Indigenous Fijian culture. And I think that that's a really interesting way to kind of think, like, what could the other meanings of silence be? Because silence is not always about erasure, like there was something there before and there's not something there now. Silence doesn't need to be necessarily bound to that. There can be very respectful silences. There can be very reverential silences. There can be very warm and inclusive silences, you know, that we experience and that we move with. But for some reason, particularly in Western philosophy, silence is kind of diminished to this idea of lack or loss or emptiness, when really, silence tells us so many different things. That's not just about the omission of something.
We started off by talking about how there has been a lot of cultural critique about the visual gaze, and you've really invited us to interrogate listening and to not see it as a universalized way of engaging the world. I know your work has focused more so on sounds, and I'm also curious if you've thought through the ways that our other sensorial experiences ought to be interrogated as well, like our senses of touch, taste, smell, and ultimately, what are the underlying threads here, as in where might leaning into these questions of universality lead us?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I also don't think that listening can really be taken away from the other senses. I never really feel like there's this clear-cut distinction. I mean, I certainly feel like sometimes I could like taste sounds, or I can see sounds, or there's always this kind of, the boundaries are messy. Just recently, I had the opportunity with a collaborator of mine, artistic co-producer Marin Aletikau, to work on a project called Oceanic Refractions, which was an interactive and immersive installation that's based a bit on the work that we've been doing in the Pacific. And we worked with sound artists and filmmakers, but we also worked with an olfactory artist to create the scent of a story that I was told by a good friend of both Mare and myself, Christelle Lavaki, who was a marine biologist at the time. And she told us about her experience of going to Lau Island in Fiji after Cyclone Winston, which was a Category 5 cyclone that made landfall in Fiji. And it was the worst cyclone to hit the Southern Hemisphere at the time. And she was talking about what the beach was like afterwards. She had to go there to kind of do an inventory of the scale of destruction on the marine life and on the reef and stuff. And she was talking about just seeing the beach lined with the bodies of marine animals and seaweed, and this kind of image of all of these bodies and plants and material like on the beach that shouldn't be there, you know, and talking about the smell of that, like the post-cyclonic kind of aftermath in a way. And we worked with an olfactory artist to try to recreate that smell, or to create a smell that was similar to that. And it was so interesting, the different experiences and memories that people who interacted with the exhibition spoke about in terms of the smell. So it really evoked for people like a harbor that they grew up on, or a bay where their grandparents lived, or like it had these kinds of resonances with people in all of these really interesting ways. And it was so fascinating to think, wow, like, again, there is no universalized smell. Some people didn't smell the smell at all, which was really intriguing to me, because for me, it was like migraine level of of overwhelm. Like, I wouldn't classify it as a nice smell. It was like the smell of like rotting fish and seaweed and diesel and plastic, and it was quite intense smell. But then someone also said that they were like, oh, was it the smell of feet? And it was just such a great experience to be like, wow, people really interpret things really differently. For me, it was so clearly one particular thing. And the fact that other people could, not for the life of me would I ever have thought that it smelled like feet, you know what I mean? And also not for the life of me would I have ever thought that someone couldn't smell it, you know, that it was just like completely absent, because it was such a strong, I don't know how to say it, like it wasn't a light scent, you know what I mean? Like it was definitely, you could taste it almost, like it was that dense. You could almost feel the oiliness on your skin. This exact approach to listening is, I feel like across all the senses, a universalized experience is, it's just such a fallacy. And I don't actually know why we still kind of default to that.
Right. There's no objectivity and there's no universality. And like smells and every other environmental cues are really richly storied and uniquely storied for each of our bodies. So that's definitely very vital to remember. This has been super fascinating. We are coming to a close for our main discussion, and your work just traverses so many themes and curiosities that I couldn't even begin to know how to ask. So I would love to leave this space for you to share anything else lingering on your mind that you feel called to share here, as well as any calls to action or deeper inquiry for our listeners.
It's true. I don't think that there is a universal smell or a universal listening or anything like that, but I do think that there spaces for resonance where we can have conversations about things, you know, and I think that it's in opening up that uncertainty where things become super interesting. It's really in opening up to say, hey, this is my experience. What's your experience? You know, like to break down this kind of tendency towards assimilating everybody's experience into your own, but actually allowing for difference as a fantastic thing, the necessity of working across and through and with difference rather than fearing that. I think that's really where all of this is interesting for me, you know, and going back to, again, what I was talking at the beginning as well, like how to organize across difference, how to not see the difference as something that is a threat or something that needs to be absorbed into one kind of understandable thing, but to say, how do we actually navigate this all the time in a useful way?
Well, Green Dreamer, we are coming to a close here, but we will have more references and resources from this episode linked in our show notes at greendreamer.com. And for now, Amer, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's been an honor to speak with you, so we really appreciate you being here. As we wrap up, what final words of wisdom do you have for us as Green Dreamers?
Listening in itself isn't enough, and that people will always tell you what they need. So make sure that when people ask you something, you enact what they actually are asking.
Green Dreamer is a community-powered podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our work and tune into our extended and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. Our production manager and researcher is Anissa Simohali. Our writer and audio editor is Yasmin Danoon, and I'm your host and producer, Kamea Shane. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you soon in our next episode.